Claims have again, the news media these like anyone else, just in the last few years, not become acquainted with this idiotic. Been to several over the last few years. Think I was in Africa last year, and maybe the year before with Brother Harry. Haven't been the last couple. We try to come when we can. And see the faces every year that I'm here. And as Brother Mike mentioned last night, we've also been losing some. I was reminded of that yesterday morning. My dad, let's just say he's not built that savvy. He's still got an old flip phone. More. Took it first to my oldest daughter. She couldn't really figure out what's going on with it. And his voicemail was full. He's never seen a voicemail in his life. And he got to the point where he just wasn't ringing anymore. Just wouldn't do anything. And so I'm going to be cleaning out the old voicemail messages. And the first one I hear is Brother Dwight Thomas. And that's, you know, not what you really expected. And he was one who was always here that I can remember. And he was calling my dad to check on my mom. And they were both fighting cancer at the same time. And we lost both of them within a year or so of each other. And of course, we lost Brother Harry a few months ago. And, you know, it's, as we, you know, we read the Bible, we read these people, we didn't know any of them. It wasn't as personal to us in some ways. They all lived and died. And, you know, it means a little more to us when it's people we know, it's love to pass on, but that's the cycle of life. We're born, we live, we die. But what do we do with those years that we have here? God's plan never changes. He's had a plan from the beginning. And, you know, what do we do with what he gives us? Brother Donald approached me a few months ago, asked me about speaking, gave me a topic, and biblical history of the church. I didn't think much about it for a while. I'm a procrastinator. Then when I finally got to looking at it, I'm like, this topic should be the topic for the entire meeting. And if you think about the biblical history of the church, and we could talk all day today and tomorrow on just that. So I guarantee you, if you have any things in mind that I should talk about, I'm probably not going to talk about some of them. It's just too much. But when we think about the church, okay, God's had a plan for that long before Christ ever came. In fact, the scriptures tell us that Christ has already planned, it's planned for him to come and die on the cross before the world ever began. The word church itself has no religious significance. It simply means a gathering, those who are called out. You even see in Acts 7, 37 and 38, it says, this is that Moses who said unto the children of Israel, a prophet of the Lord your God shall raise up you of your brethren, like unto me, him shall ye hear. This is he that was in the church in the wilderness. Now, it was not the church as we know it, but still it was God's called out people. You could technically apply the same word, the same Greek word that we use to come to church from, to group people to show up for a concert or a ball game. They're there for that purpose. They came out of the community, the society, whatever, came together for that purpose. But of course, ours is a little more special than a ball game or a concert or something like that. The word church occurs about 120 times. All but two of those are after the church is established. One of them, in I think Matthew 18, really doesn't apply necessarily to the church. Again, it's just a matter of a group. But the other one is kind of special. That's in Matthew 16, beginning verse 15, where Christ is talking to his disciples and said unto them, who do you say I am? And Simon Peter answered and said, thou art the Christ, the Son of the living God. Jesus answered and said unto them, blessed art thou, Simon Bar-Jonah, for flesh and blood hath not revealed it unto thee, but thy Father which is in heaven. And I say also unto thee, thou art Peter, and upon this rock I will build my church. Jesus' church. It slip this morning, we were getting dressed. Somebody was heckling the president in the White House, and he said, "Hey, wait a minute. This is mine." That's the kind of way I think we need to look at the church. It's not ours. No matter how long we've gone there, you know, maybe we were instrumental in building a building where a church meets, but it's Jesus' church. It's his house. He sets the rules. The church was established around the year 30 AD, about 7 weeks after the death of Jesus. For the first 3.5 years, best we can tell, the church consisted entirely of Jews. We'll look at a prophecy in a little bit that points toward that. When I was thinking about what to talk about, we spend so much of our time, when we're looking at the church in the New Testament, because that's where we find our examples, our commandments, what we should be doing, what we shouldn't be doing, and that's what we focus on. Well, I decided to take a little different approach, and, you know, usually when God's going to do something important, he tells us ahead of time. We call it prophecy. And there are many prophecies concerning the coming of the church in the Old Testament. And I thought I would spend more time looking at some of those, because that's what we usually spend less time looking at than all of the doctrinal things and stuff like that, which, you know, we're more familiar with on a day-to-day basis. I guess the first, and it's not a direct reference, but I think we can tie in, the first reference we might could give to the church would be in Genesis chapter 12. Where in the first 3 verses, the Lord said unto Abram, "Get thee out of thy country, and from thy kindred, and from thy father's house, unto a land that I will show thee. And I will make thee a great nation, and I will bless thee, and make thy name great, and thou shalt be a blessing. And I will bless him that bless thee, and curse him that curse thee, and in thee shall all families of the earth be blessed." And we know that's a reference to the coming of Christ. You can't separate the coming of Christ from the church. Now, we are more blessed in some ways than those who lived before the Christian era, simply from the standpoint that we see the fullness of God's plan. We know what it's all about. I don't think it gives us any advantage in terms of we have a better shot at going to heaven than they did. Because we're responsible for the information we're given, what we do with it. You know, if we know more, we'll be held more accountable. Then we look in the book of Isaiah, 2nd chapter, beginning verse 2. "It shall come to pass in the last days that the mountain of the Lord's house shall be established in the top of the mountains, and shall be exalted above the hills, and all nations shall flow into it. And many people shall go and say, Come ye, and let us go up to the mountain of the Lord, to the house of the God of Jacob. And he will teach us of his ways, and we will walk in his paths. For out of Zion shall go forth the law, and the word of the Lord from Jerusalem. And he shall judge among the nations, and shall rebuke many people. And they shall beat their swords into plowshares, and their spears into pruning hooks. Nation shall not lift up sword against nation, neither shall they learn war anymore." I think we've heard that passage over and over again. That's a beautiful reference to the coming of the church. A time that, you know, perhaps we take for granted. But it's the most beautiful time in human history when we can see fully God's love for man manifested, and his plan for salvation. And those who lived under the old law, you know, they knew that God was there, that he loved, that he protected, but they didn't see all of it. Micah chapter 4, the first 5 verses, is almost identical to Isaiah chapter 2. Then we can look at the book of Joel, chapter 2, beginning verse 27. "And ye shall know that I am in the midst of Israel, and that I am the Lord your God, and none else. And my people shall never be ashamed. And it shall come to pass afterward that I will pour out my spirit upon all flesh. And your sons and your daughters shall prophesy, and your old men shall dream dreams. you young men shall see visions. And also upon the servants and upon the handmaids in those days will I pour out my spirit, and I will show wonders in the heavens and in the earth, blood and fire and pillars of smoke. And the sun shall be turned into darkness, the moon into blood, before the great and terrible day of the Lord come. And it shall come to pass that whosoever shall call on the name of the Lord shall be delivered. For in Mount Zion and in Jerusalem shall be deliverance. And the Lord has said, and in the remnant through whom the Lord shall call. Y'all wonder sometimes what the prophets who wrote these things and others who read them, what they really thought some of these things meant. We know the Jews as a whole were looking for basically the second coming of David. An earthly king to restore the glory of Israel and to make things like they had been centuries before. They weren't looking for a spiritual kingdom at all. Then we can look in the book of Daniel. One of my favorite books in the entire Bible. Daniel was blessed to receive several prophecies, interpreted dreams. Daniel 2 begins the 31st verse. Your king Nebuchadnezzar has had a dream, a very troubling dream to him. And nobody could interpret it until Daniel came along. Daniel begins to interpret his dream. Thou, O king, sawest, and behold, a great image. This great image, whose brightness was excellent, stood before thee, and the form thereof was terrible. The image's head was of fine gold, his breast and his arms of silver, his belly and his thighs of brass, his legs of iron, his feet part of iron and part of clay. Thou sawest still that a stone was cut out without hands, which smote the image upon his feet that were of iron and clay. Break them in pieces. Then was the iron, the clay, the brass, the silver, and the gold broken in pieces, to pieces together, and became like the chaff of the summer threshing floors. And the wind carried them away, and no place was found for them. And the stone that smote the image became a great mountain, and filled the whole earth. This is the dream, and we will tell the interpretation thereof before the king. Thou, O king, art a king of kings, for the God of heaven hath given thee a kingdom, power and strength and glory. And whosoever the children, wheresoever the children of men dwell, the beasts of the field and the fowls of the heaven hath he given into thine hand, and hath made thee ruler over them all. Thou art this head of gold. And after thee shall arise another kingdom inferior to thee, and another third kingdom of brass, which shall bear rule over all the earth. And the fourth kingdom shall be strong as iron, for as much as iron breaketh in pieces and subdueth all things. As iron that breaketh all these, shall it break in pieces and bruise. And whereas thou sawest the feet and toes, part of potter's clay and part of iron, the kingdom shall be divided. There shall be in it the strength of the iron, for as much as thou sawest the iron mixed with miry clay. And the toes of the feet were part of iron and part of clay, so the kingdom shall be partly strong and partly broken. And whereas thou sawest iron mixed with miry clay, they shall mingle themselves with the seed of men, but they shall not cleave one to another, even as iron is not mixed with clay. And in the days of these kings shall the God of heaven set up a kingdom, which shall never be destroyed. And the kingdom shall not be left to other people, but it shall break in pieces and consume all these kingdoms, and it shall stand forever. For as much as thou sawest that the stone was cut out of the mountain without hands, and that it brake in pieces the iron, the brass, the clay, the silver, and the gold, the great God has made known to the king what shall come to pass hereafter. And the dream is certain, and the interpretation thereof is sure. Nebuchadnezzar, the king of Babylon, has been given a vision and told that after your time, at the time of your kingdom, shall come another kingdom, which was Media Persia, then another, which was Greece, and finally, the strongest of them all, Rome. And said, then, in the days of these kings, the Caesars of Rome, God going to establish his own kingdom. And this is going to be bigger and stronger and more powerful and longer lasting than all of them. He speaks of the stone cut out by hand. That, of course, is Jesus. God's kingdom is the church. We are part of that kingdom. Rome was mighty and ruled the known world for centuries. God's kingdom is now going on 2,000 years. Yes, our numbers may be dwindling. The kingdom may not be as large and strong as it has been at other times, but it continues nonetheless. And we are promised here it shall never end. Then if we move down a few chapters to Daniel chapter 9. This is a passage that a lot of our denominational friends take with some other unrelated passages and have created a couple centuries ago their doctrine of millennial reign, and Jesus is going to come back after the tribulation and establish the kingdom on earth. Well, we're talking about the kingdom already. We're part of it. It's the church. And again, we can go through the New Testament and show that, but hopefully we're already very, very well established in that idea. But in Daniel 9, beginning in chapter 24, 70 weeks are determined upon thy people and upon thy holy city to finish the transgression, to make an end of sins, and to make reconciliation for iniquity, and to bring in everlasting righteousness, to seal up the vision and prophecy, and to anoint the most holy. Now, there are, always have been, many Jews who really didn't like the book of Daniel. A lot of them just thought it was going to be thrown away. Because I think more than any book in the Bible, Daniel points to Jesus as the Messiah. And when you really look at Daniel and study it closely, you look at Jesus, you can't miss it. And I think a lot of Jews have kind of noticed that, and they don't like that conclusion, so they just put Daniel to the side. And here we see a beautiful reference not only to his coming, but what he's going to do. Make an end of sins. Make reconciliation for iniquity. To bring in everlasting righteousness. And then to seal up the vision and prophecy. So many prophecies. Over and over again throughout the centuries, it pointed to the coming of the Messiah. And he's going to fulfill every single one of them. Not most of them, all of them. And not just part way, complete. Know therefore and understand that from the going forth of the commandment to restore and to build Jerusalem unto the Messiah the Prince shall be 7 weeks, and 72 weeks. The street shall be built again in the wall, even in troublous times. And after 72 weeks shall Messiah be cut off, but not for himself. And the people of the prince that shall come shall destroy the city and the sanctuary. And the end thereof shall be with the flood. And at the end of the war, desolations are determined. And he shall confirm the covenant with many for 1 week. And in the midst of the week he shall cause the sacrifice and oblation to cease. For the overspreading of abominations, he shall make it desolate, even unto the consummation, and that determined shall be poured upon the desolate. Now, we have to understand that when we're dealing with prophecy, the time is not literal, just as the figures themselves are not. The formula used in the scriptures is that for every day given in prophecy, it means a literal year of time. So if we're looking at 70 weeks, 490 days, we're really looking at a period of 490 years. If we get to looking at this, that to me is the most beautiful part of this. So many prophecies that were given in the Old Testament, somebody could have faked meeting those prophecies if they wanted to. A few up here or there. And nobody else met all the others. Maybe close. But this one gives us the exact time that the Messiah was coming. So even if somebody did manage to make a few of the prophecies, they wouldn't have met the right time. Now, we're told that from the commandment to restore and to build Jerusalem unto the Messiah will be 490 years. And if you get to looking, you're not going to find that explicit commandment in the old law. I think if you find it, it's not explicitly saying. I also it's broken down, the period is into three. There's a 7 week or 49 day, 49 year period of time, which is the rebuilding of Jerusalem. The next, let's see, 434 years, which is the time from then until Messiah rebuilds himself. There were three trips we find that the captives made returning to Jerusalem. The first is reported in the first 2 chapters of Ezra, and it says in Ezra 1:1, this occurred in the first year of Cyrus. That was 517 B.C. So if you add the 69 weeks from then forward, you come to 34 B.C. I don't think 34 B.C. is when Jesus began to ministry. Ezra chapters 7 through 10 give us the next journey. That was Ezra himself returning. And it says in Ezra 7 and 8, this occurred in the 7th year of Artaxerxes. And I already had some numbers down. I just Googled it yesterday morning, the day before sometime, and just Wikipedia, which is not always the most reliable, but just see what it said. It gave me the exact date I already had. I'm just making sure. About 457 B.C., you add 483 to that, you come to 26 A.D. And then just for completeness sake, if you look the first 7 chapters of Nehemiah, which chronicles Nehemiah's trip back, Nehemiah 2:1 says this occurred in the 20th year of Artaxerxes, which would put us in 442 B.C. And adding 483 years would be 39 A.D., which was too late. Well, does 26 AD work? Well, it should, because we have 3.5 years of Jesus' ministry to that for 30 AD. We know he was born somewhere around 3 or 4 BC. So that seems to fit perfectly. But a lot of people look at the script of Ezra, and they don't see the commandments we saw in rebuild Jerusalem. That Daniel said would be the hallmark of the beginning of this period. In Ezra chapter 7, we can skip around and read a few verses here. Verse 11 says, now this is the copy of the letter that the king Artaxerxes gave to Ezra the priest, the scribe, even the scribe of the word of the commandments of the Lord and the statutes of Israel. Verse 18, this was the authority that Artaxerxes gave Ezra. And whatsoever shall seem good to thee and to thy brethren to do with the rest of the silver and the gold, that to do after the will of your God. Basically, whatever money's left over, do what you want to. And then in verse 21, and I, even I, Artaxerxes the king, to make a decree to all the treasures which are beyond the river, that whatsoever Ezra the priest, the scribe of the law of the God of heaven, shall require of you, it be done speedily, unto 100 talents of silver, unto 100 measures of wheat, unto 100 baths of wine, and to an oil, 100 baths of oil, and salt without prescribing how much. And thou, Ezra, after the wisdom of thy God that is in thine hand, set magistrates and judges, which may judge all the people that are beyond the river, all such as know the laws of thy God, and teach ye them that know them not. And whosoever will not do the law of thy God, and the law of the king, let judgment be executed speedily upon him. He's given Ezra the authority to set up government, still under the authority of King Artaxerxes, but you set up judges and magistrates, and you oversee this area. It's yours. You can do what you want. You can rule it. As long as you still answer to me. Now, is that the authority to restore and rebuild Jerusalem? I think yes, physically and politically. And what clinches it to me is when we then look at the book of Nehemiah, chapter 1, verses 3 and 4. Now here, some have come back from Jerusalem and have reported the condition of things to Nehemiah. And they said unto me, he says, the remnant that are left of the captivity there in the province are in great affliction and reproach. The wall of Jerusalem also is broken down, and the gates thereof are burned with fires. Well, Nebuchadnezzar did that 100 years ago. So should that be news? And it came to pass when I heard these words that I sat down and wept and mourned certain days and fasted and prayed before the God of heaven. Why is Nehemiah so distraught by the fact that the walls are torn down and the gates are burned with fire? That's clearly not what he expected here. In my mind, Nehemiah knew that the walls, the gates should be have been fixed by now. Now whether they had been fixed, and we know that there was a lot of animosity from people who were living in that area, and they're constantly battling them. Ezra and Nehemiah, they're told as they're working on the wall, you basically got to have one hand on what you're doing, another hand on your sword almost. You may be attacked at any moment. So I don't know if these things had been fixed at one point and had been torn down and burned again, or if just they hadn't managed to fix it yet. But either way, Nehemiah expected they would have been repaired at this point. So that says to me that they knew the authority had already been given toward Jerusalem. The last words that we see in the Old Testament, in the book of Malachi, chapter 4, verses 4 through 6, is the last words that God leaves his people with for several hundred years of silence. I say silence. The book of Daniel had many prophecies which should have guided them and comforted them as things unfolded, just as Revelation does for us today. Remember ye the law of Moses my servant, which I commanded unto him in Horeb for all Israel, with the statutes and judgments. Behold, I will send you Elijah the prophet before the coming of the great and dreadful day of the Lord. And he shall turn the heart of the fathers to the children, and the heart of the children to their fathers, lest I come and smite the earth with a curse. So he tells them, keep the commandments. Follow the law that I gave to you through Moses, because there's going to, it's going to be a while. I guess you'd say that, but I'm going to send Elijah, so John the Baptist. I'm going to send him, because he was the one who made way, prepared the hearts of people for the coming of Jesus himself. And so you can say he's also laying the foundation for the establishment of the church. We know that the church's birthday, like Ken's got one today, church's birthday was the day of Pentecost, about 30 AD, almost 2,000 years ago. And I don't care how many times I hear it, to me, those are the most beautiful words in the Bible when we read of the response of those who were calling for the crucifixion of Jesus. How just 7 weeks later, Peter and the others preached to them, and so many of them realized their error, and then how they responded. Acts 2:41, then they that gladly received his word were baptized, the same day were added unto them about 3,000 souls. How often do we go sometimes at our congregation between baptism? They had 3,000 in one day. They continued steadfastly in the apostles' doctrine and fellowship and breaking bread and prayers. And fear came upon every soul, and many wonders and signs were done by the apostles. And all that believed were together, and all things common. They sold their possessions and goods, and parted them to all men, as every man had need. And they, continuing daily with one accord in the temple, and breaking bread from house to house, did eat their meat with gladness and singleness of heart, praising God and having favor all the people. And the Lord added to the church daily such as should be saved. If you were here last evening, And Brother Mike talked about being happy. His title was, "Don't Worry, Be Happy." What picture do you see of these people right here? They don't seem to have fear in the world. Maybe you've heard the Jews themselves are kind of in shock of what's going on, and there was a lot of persecution. But still, joy and bliss, they got it. They realized what it had all been about for 4,000 years. And it all had come to this point. And they had been privileged and blessed to have lived in that time. Even though, yes, they may have said, "Crucify him." They still got to see. They probably got to hear him teach. Now here they were listening to Peter, John, and all the others. They understood God's mercy and grace. And sometimes we think we mess up, will God forgive me? Think about them. If you were the only one who stood there and said, "Crucify him." Here you are a few weeks later being baptized in his blood. That doesn't give you a picture of how merciful and forgiving God is. I don't know what would. But it says in verse 47, "The Lord added to the church daily such as should be saved." So it's this church which is prophesied over and over again. We just hit a few of them in the Old Testament. And then we can go through and look at all the writings of Paul and Peter and John and Jude and others to see how the church itself developed, how things progressed, and grew. Acts 4 and 4, howbeit many of them which heard the word believed, and the number of the men were about 5,000. Sometimes you get reports, and I'm sure Ron seen it to some degree, in Africa. You can have several baptized at once. 3,000, 5,000. I don't think the world will ever see that again. And then if you go on to Revelation, the letters we see in chapters 2 and 3 paint a picture for us of the eras to which the church would progress. I think we are now in the final one, the era of Laodicea, the era of lukewarmness, which I think, if we're honest, we see in our world today. I think, again, that's why we do see sometimes more reception to the gospel in Africa or in the Philippines. And Brother Wayne and Brother Edward were there a few months ago. In other words, people have less. They see the need for God more. So the church continues. And for many generations now, it's been very strong in this time. Will that continue? Don't know. You can see it's having planted in other places. The church will be flourishing. The lobby will be there. Got a little something going in Tanzania, which is still kind of uncertain about. Brother Harry's very instrumental in that work for many years. And I think all of us want to see that continue. It had been my desire to go back to Africa this year. It just didn't work out. I'm looking right now for somebody to go with me next year. I want to get plans made and get everything set so this doesn't happen next year. Because somebody kind of canceled on me a little too late to find somebody else. So, Ron, are you ready to go back? Anybody else, please let me know. Just when we look at the history of the church, I don't want that to be all there is history. I want to be looking to a future. As much of futures we can have here, but the harder hearted, the more lukewarm people get here, the more imperative it probably is that we turn to places of people who are more receptive. Always going to be a need for those to go to those places and to teach and carry on that work. I'll ask if there are questions or comments. comments anybody wants to make? For your attention.